So, great. Good morning, everyone. Thank you all for coming. It's nice to see you all. I'm Joan Devine. I'm the pediatric outreach nurse for Children's Hospital at Dartmouth-Hitchcock. And this is the School Health Symposium, Cancer, Celiac Concerns, Concussions. It's a mouthful. Before we begin, I have a few housekeeping tips to let you know about. First off, since I've been asked a few times now, the ladies' rooms are much more accessible because we have this beautiful new building. So there's one out here, just go out, make a right, and you'll see it. But then if you go out into the hallway, there's numerous facilities. So that'll make your day a little bit easier. So I'm having a little trouble with the computer. I think it's tired. So today, we're starting with Dr. Julie Kim. We got many requests for this. I should let you know that I have a lovely planning committee of Candy Natty, who's sitting in the middle, and Pam Hausler, who's somewhere in here, who helped this morning with registration. Candy works at Hanover High, and Pam's right over there. Pam's at the Marion Cross School. And we meet, we look at previous evaluations to come together with a program that we hope will meet your needs. And as I mentioned, cancer was a very big request, and luckily Dr. Kim was available to speak with us today. And then we often and always need to know about concussions. I think we do this frequently. Dr. Jonathan Lichtenstein is a real expert in this field, and he'll come and speak with us. And we'll have a little break. And then perennial favorite, Christine Carlson's coming to speak. Chris is a sports medicine family physician, and she can talk about any injury any child can get, and has some really interesting slides and good slides. Then we'll have lunch. Lunch day is catered by Panera Bread. It'll be out in the hallway. Enjoy your lunch. I'm giving you an hour so you guys can network and catch up with each other. Then Lynn Lyons was a request. Lynn is a social worker down in Concord with a private practice. She's very busy lecturing around the country, talking on anxiety in children. And she'll be joining us for 2 hours. And then finally, we have Dr. Pam Hoffley. Pam is a gastroenterologist down in Manchester. She's also here in Lebanon at times. And she's spoken with us before about stomach aches, and she's going to continue that conversation. And then we adjourn at 3:30. So today's activity carries 5.75 contact hours. And we have a new way of giving out credit. So CLPD used to be CCEHS. It's the Center for Learning and Professional Development. They will be sending you a link after the conference tomorrow or perhaps Monday on how to evaluate the program and how to get your credit. For those who are live streaming, just be aware that if you have any questions for the faculty, you can email me at joan.r.devine@hitchcock.org, and I will let the faculty know your questions. So now I get to introduce Marcus. Marcus Jenkin is from the Center for Learning and Professional Development, and he's going to talk more about the online evaluation. Just because it's different, it's not difficult. It's just different, and I want to make sure everyone knew how to do it. So, Marcus.
Sure.
Yours.
Good morning, everybody. Good morning. I'm Marcus Jenkin. I'm here from the Center for Learning and Professional Development to talk about online credit claiming and evaluations. This is new. If you've been to a live activity before, you probably have received a credit claim sheet of paper. You've filled it out. You've submitted it. You've waited and waited and waited for your contact hours to show up on your transcript. This is a new way of doing things. This links your contact hours claiming to your evaluation. What this does is it speeds everything up for you. Once you've claimed and submitted your evaluation, your contact hours are on your transcript, and you're good to go. So I'm going to kind of walk through this. The first thing to really point out is you will, as Joan said, you will receive an email from CLPD at the conclusion of this activity. That's important. Please do not delete that email. It includes all the instructions I'm going to go over right now. It will also include this link right here, which is the link to your Continuing Education for Professionals account. So this is how you will initially be accessing your evaluation. So I'm going to run through this for you. If you're a walk-in, things are going to be a little bit slower for you. We understand that your account might not have been created, your registration might not have been processed. So everything that I say now is for people who pre-registered. Everybody who's a walk-in, things will be delayed just a little bit. because we need to get you registered in our account. So when you first receive that email and that link, all you're going to do is you're going to click on that link, and it's going to drive you to your account. You just need to log in. If you pre-registered for this activity, you're just going to log in with the credentials that you use to register for this activity. If you have any problems logging in, if you get confused, don't spend a lot of time trying to figure it out. You've got a dedicated support person to help you out. That number, if you need it, is 653-1234. Roy's there to help. We know this is new. We don't want anybody to get frustrated with this or worry about what's going on in the process. So, there to help. So you're going to log into your account, and the majority of you are going to be driven right to this page. If you're not driven to this page, you're going to be driven to your account profile, which is going to have a couple fields probably that you need to fill out. This pertains mostly to the walk-ins if we didn't have all of your required information. The majority of you are going to wind up right here. Okay. You get here, you're inside your continuing education for professionals account. What you're going to do is you're going to click on that link right there that says My Activities. That's going to take you to a list of your online activities. I'm going to use Yellow Belt here as an example. You're going to see School Health Symposium in this list. All you're going to do is click on it to select it. Clicking on that link is going to take you to the School Health Symposium activity page. The activity page is the same one you probably saw when you registered for this course. Shouldn't be anything new to you, but if it is, here's kind of what it looks like. Up in the right-hand corner, there's a resume button. You're going to click the resume button to resume your activity to get into the content and evaluation section of the activity. If you've already accessed the online handouts, this is where you were, so this should look familiar to you. If you haven't accessed the online handouts, you'll access them the same way that you would access the evaluation after the course. Okay? So you can see this page with a couple of tabs in it. You can click that continue button to proceed through those tabs there. Along the way, you can download the online handouts if you want to. At the end of the string, you're going to find your evaluation. There's a button there that's called Launch. You're going to launch your evaluation. It's going to bring up your evaluation in a new window. It's all the questions that you've probably seen before about evaluating the course. One thing that's new about this is where you'll select the number of contact hours that you're claiming. Okay? So there's going to be a link. Oh, missed it. All right. Not there. Anyway, so you'll have an evaluation pop up, and there will be a question that will tell you to select the number of contact hours that you're claiming. It's just a drop-down field. You'll just click it. You'll select the number of contact hours that you're claiming. You'll complete the evaluation the same as you've done before, and you'll click that Submit button. Once you click the Submit button, you're done. You've submitted your evaluations. You've claimed your credit. If for any reason you need to go back and get your transcript, go back here, you do it through your account. Same place, just call online transcripts. You can just click that, it will bring up your transcript and you can print it off from there. So everything's driven through your continuing education for professionals account. You have 30 days to do the evaluation from today. So if you're a walk-in, your time will be a little bit compressed depending on when you get registered. That'll probably be in a couple days. You will receive an email. If you don't receive an email from us, please contact us. Again, this is new. We have tested it. We have done it at a number of other activities. It's worked pretty well. We don't want to leave anybody out in the cold or have anybody be confused about the way this is working, all right? So just contact our support person and we'll make sure that it works out for you. Is there any questions about this before I turn it back over?
Alrighty. Remember, his number is 653-1234. So if you have problems, he's happy to help you. And so am I. So, but you know who I am. I would just direct it to Marcus. But thanks, Marcus. So Okay, said that. And finally, I want to thank our exhibitors. I hope you visit them. New Hampshire Immunization Program and New Hampshire Injury Prevention Program. They're right outside the door here. And then I just want to bring your attention to our Shield the Children from Harm Conference. It's April 19th. This conference is our child abuse conference that we do every year. It's always in April. Dr. Lynn Sheese from Wisconsin is our keynote speaker, and there are some brochures on the registration desk if you want more information. Registration is open, and it will be here. So, without further ado, I will introduce our first speaker, Dr. Julie Kim. So, Dr. Kim is an assistant professor of pediatrics. She's also the associate program director for the pediatric residency program here, and she's the director of our pediatric comprehensive sickle cell program. She received her MFA at Brown University in Providence. I'll be going there next week. And went on to get her MD and PhD at the West Virginia University School of Medicine. She did her residency at Yale University as well as her fellowship there. And as I mentioned, Dr. Kimsman was very happy to be asked to speak to this group. So let's give her a nice welcome.
Well, thanks for having me. So I was actually very excited to come here and talk, because even though we don't have that many kids in this public school system who have cancer, when a kid does arrive there in your fields, it does cause quite an uproar, particularly from the parent side. I think the schools do a very good job handling it, but doing that transition can be a little bit difficult. So this is a good opportunity to talk about this. So I wanted to thank you for coming, and I wanted to thank you guys for all the hard work you guys do with our patients. So our objectives for today, this is kind of a loose objective because we can go wherever we want to go, you know, with this discussion. So I'd like to review some things about cancer in general. This is mostly about empowering you guys to feel comfortable about taking care of our kids. So empowering you to recognize, manage, and help the other people in your school feel comfortable having children with cancer in your school. And then also I'd like to spend a little bit of time brainstorming about how we can improve this transition process and how we could be of more help to you guys. So this is kind of how I think of how we should be working, kind of a circular thing, not necessarily these things are all combined. So we should really think of a unit, of being a unit together to help our kids. So as you know, kids in general, they complain of a lot of things. You know, they complain of stomach aches, they complain of, you know, just not feeling well, they've got rashes in school, they've got, you know, you don't know what you're seeing when they come into the door. But we have had school nurses who figured out something is really wrong with the kid and sends them in their appropriate direction. I'm always impressed about that. And even though we all know the symptoms of leukemia, whoever thinks that this child has leukemia or some kind of cancer, it's just not the first thing that should be on your mind. And there's a reason that it shouldn't be the first thing on your mind. Cancer just doesn't happen that frequently in kids. And when you think of the actual symptoms in children, these are children, the symptoms are small. I mean, the number of times that it is cancer or something really scary is pretty small. So the things that parents worry about is swollen glands here. In pediatric patients, it's only cancer 1 out of 1,000 times that they actually come to see us. So they come to see us 999 times, and it's not actually a cancer. So what do we tell parents about swollen glands, and what should you guys know about swollen glands? In pediatric patients, adults don't feel glands because the lymph nodes atrophy at around early teenage years. And it makes sense. You know, the lymph nodes are supposed to fight infection. They're seeing new infections every single day. So until they're about teenage years, when they've kind of seen most of everything, these lymph nodes you should be able to feel. And there's studies that show that a good pediatrician or good provider should feel a lymph node somewhere 100% of the time for any child 13 and under. Now, this is unusual for kids or for adults, though. Adults are not supposed to feel any lymph nodes. So that's why parents get so freaked out about the whole lymph node thing. And I have to have this discussion with them all the time. The size of a normal lymph node for a kid can be up to 2 centimeters, actually. And if it's an inguinal node, it could be 3 centimeters. So we don't worry about it unless it's really big, like golf ball size, and it can't be wiggled around anywhere. And again, just feeling one is often freaks out parents and freaks out adults who aren't familiar with this fact about what lymph nodes do for kids. Persistent back pain, again, this is something that's a frequent complaint, but it's only cancer 1 out of 1,000 times. Persistent tiredness. Now, what teenager doesn't have persistent tiredness? I mean, this is crazy. And then frequent bruising. All those kids who are playing sports, that's, you know, they're bruising around too. So it's hard to tell sometimes of what's going on. The interesting thing to me is sometimes, and we'll talk about this kind of down the road, the nurses or the school will figure out something is wrong and not quite know what it is. And then parents, we actually see them. The parents are upset that they didn't figure it out earlier. And it's kind of like, are you kidding me? So we have that discussion with families all the time that, no, they figured out something was wrong. They didn't know exactly what was wrong. And it was your job to bring your kid to their primary care provider or to take the next step. They're not going to diagnose anybody at school. One of the things about pediatric cancers, as you guys know, only 1 out of 500 children will get cancer. These are just the statistics. So if you're taking care of a school of 500 kids, you may not see that many cancers. And there may be a rash somewhere here, somewhere there, and you might not ever see any, or you might see 10. You have no idea in your career. Cancer is really rare for children. For every 200 people diagnosed with cancer, about one of them is a child. So the experience that adults have with cancer, we always remind the parents and schools, is very different for kids. So don't go on the internet, all of those things. It doesn't apply. And just for your knowledge, in general, the lifetime risk of getting a cancer, if you're a male, is 1 out of 2. If you're a female, it's 1 out of 3. So the prevalence is much higher than people recognize sometimes, which scares me because when I eat a steak, I'm like, ooh. So what do we see for our pediatric patients with cancer? This is a very different profile than what the adults see. So adults most commonly see solid tumor types of cancer. In the pediatric world, we see mostly liquid, what we call liquid tumors. So acute lymphoblastic leukemia is the most common one, and then followed by brain tumors. Now, that's a scary thought, too, because leukemia can present in all kinds of different ways. You know, those lymph nodes, that back pain, the mild not feeling well overall, that could be any symptom. But if we see it in our world, it's generally the lymphoblastic leukemias. Brain tumors, as you can imagine, how many kids show up in your office with headache? That's something that's scary, and it actually takes a while for somebody to be diagnosed with a brain tumor. If you go and look at the averages of how long it takes for somebody to be diagnosed, something like leukemia doesn't take long because that comes on very quickly, so that may just be a month. Brain tumors can be up to 3, 4, 5 months before somebody figures out that something is really wrong here. And in the meantime, they're coming to your office complaining of headache the entire time, and then we see them and the family's upset that no one picked it up any sooner, which is unfair to you guys, I recognize. And we do try to have that conversation with them. Every day in the United States, 43 kids are diagnosed with a cancer, which is seems like a lot. It's a lot less than adults. So I thought I would talk to you about what we actually tell the families the first time we're telling them that they have a cancer, because I think that first initial interaction with families can make a huge difference about how everything else goes in your relationship with that family. So we actually have something called a day one talk, which is a very well-described thing and pretty much what all pediatric oncologists do, to have this conversation with the families. And one of the things that's been kind of broken down, we did this day one talk. The adults figured out, oh, the day one talk that the pediatric patients are using is pretty good. So then they came up, the adults came up, oncologists came up with this SPIKES protocol, and they kind of simplified what the pediatric patients or pediatric oncologists were doing. This SPIKES protocol is basically what we do, and I wish we had, the pediatricians had thought to come up with some fancy acronym for that beforehand. So we do set up an interview. This is kind of ask, you know, making sure they come into their office. We turn off our pagers. We make sure that the families, we actually ask the families not to use their cell phones during that time period, which is really hard, amazingly. We ask the families why they're here. What is it that you've been told already? It's amazing how many families come into our office and have not been told that we think your child has a cancer, that they go to the emergency room or they see their primary care physicians, and then they get referred to us and they realize it's the cancer center and they're like, do you think my kid has cancer? And I can understand that. It's very hard to come up and tell a family bad news potentially. So we do ask families, and then we ask them, so what is it that, or how is it that you learn best? You know, what ways do you learn? Do you learn better with verbal communication, written communication? Do you like to know numbers? Do you like to know one step at a time? Or do you want to just know a bigger picture in general? We also ask at this point, you know, like, who else is here to help you learn? Like, how do you interact with your school? Are they going to be a support for you? Your families, those kinds of things. So we get that invitation to try to figure out what's going on. And then we start talking about what it is that they want to know, the knowledge piece. And obviously, throughout this whole thing, it's very emotional for the families, and it's emotional for the kids, too. So we recognize that, and then we come up with some strategy and then summarize what's been talked about that day. What do we do with the kids versus the parents? Like, do we talk to the kids at the parents at the same time? We actually leave that up to the parents somewhat, and somewhat up to the kids, too. So if it's a teenage child, we try to get some sense of where they are intellectually, socially, just maturity-wise. If we think the child is old enough to hear a lot of this, we'll say to the kid, you know, we'll talk about some basic things. Then there's a lot of boring stuff that we're going to talk about. And so I'll let you talk to the child life specialist or meet some other people in the clinic while I talk with your parents. Then I talk to the parents and we talk about some of the nitty-gritty. We talk about how is it that your child learns the best? What do you think would be a good way to talk to your child? A lot of parents have no idea when you ask this question. So we do have to do some guidance about that. And for the kids, the younger kids, sometimes we have the kids go to the playroom and we talk to the parents separately, which I think is important because the parents need a chance to break down and cry without their kid present. So we do some separation like that. The nice thing about spikes is I figured out it works well with my adolescent kids. So what is cancer? Cancer is a whole, depending on what you look at, it's a whole conglomeration of a bunch of different things. So some people used to think, and probably still is, something wrong with the very innate stem cell in our bone. So the stem cell is like the first thing that turns into everything else in our body. So some people think in the pediatric world that there's a stem cell problem. And that idea that there's a stem cell problem is why some of the treatments, when we think it's a stem cell problem, can be 3 years long because we're trying to retrain that stem cell. Other people, and I think it's all probably multifactorial actually. Some other people think that there's a genetic mutation, they get exposed to another second hit, so there's that second hit hypothesis, and we turn on that genetic mutation to start doing the wrong thing. Either way, there's some DNA, something that goes wrong with the DNA. The whole checks and balances, like there's these tumor suppressor genes, that something goes wrong that we are not. Mutation that we know causes a cancer. They found that in Australia, about 1 in 100,000 people have that mutation running around in their blood, but it doesn't cause cancer in them. Somehow our bodies fight that off. We recognize it. So every time that we're doing something, you know, just living, our DNA is, you know, our cells are changing and multiplying, something's going to make a mistake, but our body usually fights that off. And I talk about this with families. One of the questions that families have is, did I do something to cause my kid's cancer? And I always say, no, it's nothing that you ate, it's nothing that you drank, it's not any exposures that you have. There is some controversy like pesticides, you know, do you live near electromagnetic wires, you know, those towers? And I still tell them, no, it's nothing that you ate or drank, because it wasn't their choice probably to live next to the electromagnetic tower. This was their financial situation that they were probably in. They were making the best choice at the time they did. And so no point in looking backwards. And no parents would deliberately, you know, do something that they thought was going to be harmful to their child. So I reiterate multiple times that there is nothing that they did that caused this cancer. And there are plenty of other kids who are in the exact same situation and they didn't get cancer. This is just bad luck. A conversation that we frequently have is what remission and cure is. So we don't talk about cure very often, or we actually don't talk about cure at all when we're having discussions with our families, because there is no such thing really as a cure. How can you guarantee that somebody's going to be cured? We can't guarantee that in 20 years this cancer is not going to come back. So we don't talk about cure. We talk about survival, and we talk about remission. And this is a very confusing thing for everybody, not just pediatric patients. Remission, the definition of remission is changing all the time. So remission just means we can no longer longer see it with whatever scientific method we have available to us. It doesn't mean that they're cured. We think that even though somebody's in remission, there's probably still one or two cells with that mutation still running around, just like in those healthy blood donors. So the definition of remission has changed over time, and the definition of remission will be different depending on what type of cancer you're talking about. So if it's a solid tumor, remission may mean we don't see it on the scan, but we think that there's still microscopic cells there. Remission in the leukemia patient means that we've looked at 100,000 cells. Literally, we look at 100,000 cells through a machine, and we do not see one cell that looks at that. But if we looked at 200,000 or 300,000 cells, we may still see one, but we don't have that technology to do that yet. So this is a good way. I think it's good for everybody to know what we actually talk about. We don't talk about cure. We talk about remission. We talk about five-year survival rates. Actually, I don't talk specifically about five-year. We talk about five-year survival rates among the providers, but I actually try to avoid talking about survival rates with the families because it doesn't matter for that family. Sometimes they want to know, and then I'll ask them if they actually want to know the number. But really what matters to the kid is, are they going to be in the percentage that survives, or are they going to be in the percentage that doesn't survive? And there's no, you're going to be 95% living and 5% dead. That doesn't work for anybody. So that's not so helpful for families. If the family does ask about, well, what does this look like? You know, is my kid going to do okay? Then I'll say, yeah, the chances are pretty good, because I can say that from just about every pediatric cancer, that I'm hoping and I expect that we can bring your kid to, you know, high school and college, and they should grow up. If it's not such a good prognosis, then I'll say, you know, this could be a little tough, and the majority of kids do well. The majority of kids don't do so well, but it doesn't really matter what that statistic is. What matters is your child. So I do try to individualize that. The other thing about these numbers, that there's been studies, if you actually tell families that it's a 25% prognosis, then the whole attitude towards how that family and how everybody else reacts to that child is very different. Then they're like, oh, this kid's gonna die. And parents are already thinking that anyway. They're already scared to death about that. But if you tell them a poor prognosis number, then how everybody interacts with that child is very different. But there are kids that do die. Every year we have about a little bit over 3,200 kids who die per year. It does turn out that one out of eight kids who get cancer will die. We can actually mostly tell who that one out of eight are going to be when they walk in the door. And that's because most of our kids we either have very good treatments for, and then there's some diagnoses that we don't have any good treatment for. So from the get-go, we sometimes have an idea which way they're going to be going. The other thing that we have this conversation with families is about entering a clinical trial. So unlike adults, most of our children will enter some kind of clinical trial, which sounds a little bit counterintuitive, because why would you want to do a trial on a pediatric patient? But this is the standard of care for our patients. So we do offer, if there's a trial, to do one. And it's not so much that we're experimenting on the kids. What the trials generally are, and we try to explain this to the families, are we're using what we already know works. And we're trying it against something that we think might work better, that has been shown potentially to work better on a smaller number of kids. And the reason that we're doing this is because there just aren't that many kids with cancer. So we don't have the opportunity to say, well, this works, when we think that there might be something that works better. So each year, if you're thinking that, you know, one out of 500 kids, there's only about 15,000 kids who get diagnosed, that's only like 3,000 for leukemia, 200 for this. We have some patients that or some cancers that we think there's only to be 10 per year getting that kind of cancer. So, of course, you want to be part of some bigger organization, so you have more brains thinking about this. So that's the benefit for the families, is once we enroll a patient in a trial, it's not just Dartmouth looking at their studies. We submit all their studies and their results to a national organization, and they have a centralized review. So I do think that's helpful for the families. There are different phases of trials. We tend not to do phase one or zeros or ones. Most of our patients will be in a phase two, where we're looking at effectiveness, and phase three, the larger scale studies. Just talking about a clinical trial with families is very scary for the families because they were saying, what is this? Why a clinical trial? You don't know how to treat my kid? So we have that. That's a large part of our day one discussion, or day two or three or whatever day we figure out what the actual cancer is. The other thing that's very difficult for families is to understand that there's a randomization process. So with all of these studies, there's a randomization process. They're either going to get the treatment that we know already works most of the time, or they're going to get the new treatment. And sometimes this randomization goes into four different arms because we're going to try out three different new treatments at the same time. It makes sense to us that there's a randomization, that it's a flip of the coin, but families always ask, well, I want my kid to be treated on the arm that's better, and I can't tell them. And if I knew, then it wouldn't be a study anymore. So that's adding more uncertainty to this whole picture for families. The other thing that I found out through my experience with time is we talk about arm A, arm B, arm C. I recently had a family that when we said, oh, your child was randomized to arm C, and she's like, how did that happen? I only have two arms. And I was like, oh, okay. So there's some pretty basic thinking out there when you're talking to families. Some shared treatments, features of treatments. I wasn't going to spend too much time on a specific treatment or specific diagnosis because I think that's not what is important here. What is important for you guys is to know what is the dangerous time periods and what are the families talking about when my kid is, or when I come in and said they're in induction therapy or they're consolidation therapy. What does that mean to you? So you have some ideas. So induction is actually the time where we are first meeting the patient, and it's our job at this point to try to get rid of as many cancer cells as possible. This is actually the most dangerous time for the patient, so our highest deaths occur during induction. This is also the time that we try to get them into your school as quickly as possible to try to normalize their lives. So that is a scary time for everyone, and understandably so. What you can see here is there's a dotted line here also that says this is our remission, meaning that we can't see it at this point. So a lot of times a patient will be in induction, this very scary time, and then we tell them, oh, you're in remission. We can't see it anymore. But as you can see, there's still tumor cells here. So that's the expectation. Induction, that's when infections most happen. It's when fevers most happen. It's when parents are the most freaked out and they're showing up in your office all the time, probably. We've had parents who, throughout several phases of these treatment, the mother comes and sits in their parking lot while the kid is going to school because they're too afraid to leave. So we've had some crazy behaviors like that. So induction is the immediate cell kill, so you can see the slope goes down. Consolidation is what we think of as local control. So if it's a solid tumor, we try to kill off the tumor. Consolidation may be radiation, it may be surgery to try to get rid of that the local disease. For somebody who has leukemia, it's just kind of another phase where we kind of slow things down a little bit, but we're still trying to get rid of the tumor. We always have different chemotherapies for all of these regimens. It's like tricking, you don't want them to develop resistance. So every cycle looks very different. So if we send you, if a child is in induction, their consolidation looks very different. Interim maintenance looks very different. So it's going to be a whole new set of side effects that you might be seeing. Interim maintenance. These are trying to trick the weaklings out of hiding. So we've already tried probably at this point 7 or 8 or 9 different chemotherapies, rotation. And this will be a whole new set of chemotherapy agents to get the ones that were resistant to the first two. And then we have delayed intensification, which is another scary time for families and for patients because it's another very aggressive, as you can see here, the slope, very aggressive time period of chemotherapy, and it's the kind of our last ditch, big bang, before we move into this maintenance phase. And maintenance, we had talked about the stem cells, maintenance can be 3 years for some patients. So depending on what we're trying to do and what we think the origin of their cancer is, it could be up to 3 years, especially for some boys. And the reason for that is boys have testicles. There's the blood-brain, blood-testicle barrier, which is often sometimes the same thing, I've decided. So we do have to keep giving chemotherapy to try to bypass those barriers there. So approximate treatment lengths. Acute lymphoblastic leukemia, it's the first 6 to 9 months that are very intensive chemotherapy. As we talked about, for boys, it's about 3.5 years. For girls, it's about 2.5 years. For some of the scarier, like AML is actually a more aggressive diagnosis than ALL, but the treatment is less. However, this treatment for AML is way more intensive, so this kid will be in the hospital probably for the entire year that they're getting chemotherapy. And a lot of these AML patients will go directly to transplant, so it's a very different diagnosis. Hodgkin's lymphoma, this is actually very common in our adolescent patients. These kids are getting about a year of therapy. We've figured out how to do it as an outpatient, so these kids can come every other week, get chemotherapy, and go to school all the other times, hopefully, for most of the Hodgkin's. There's a couple of Hodgkin's that we don't do that regimen for, and if we don't do that regimen, it's because we have some concern about their lung function or their heart function, but the standard is to give a chemotherapy agent. Actually, it's four chemotherapy agents every 2 weeks. Brain tumor is about a year of therapy. Brain tumors comes with its own problems for a school transition because there's a lot of cognitive issues that come with that. And then sarcomas, that's about a year. Sarcomas, those are the osteosarcomas, Ewing sarcomas, that's a combination of inpatient and outpatient therapy. For the patients who have sarcomas, we worry about physical issues because they usually have a mobility problem or they are not allowed to walk because we're afraid that tumor is going to break when they break their leg. So then that's when we have some discussions about how to manage school. We do try to manage as much outpatient as possible. So, just to review what we've talked about. We've talked a little bit about signs and symptoms, some epidemiology, and some treatment. What I'd kind of like to move to next is the transition to school. So as I said, we try to transition these kids as quickly into school as possible. One, because it is their big social support for them. And two, we want to normalize their lives as much as possible. We do have this conversation with families that we expect this cancer and this diagnosis to be a bump in the road. They still have to get to the other side, and this child still has to grow up and be a functioning adult at some point. And that school is their job, just like they have their own job. School is really their job. So we expect families, this doesn't always work. It really depends on the family. We have families, a discussion with the families that your child still needs discipline. Your child still needs to do their chores. They still need to do their homework. They might have modified homework, and they can still participate in sports. They might not participate the same way as everybody else does, but just going and being at the sideline, or if it's just walking when everybody else is running, that's important to the child's development, health, physically, but also mentally. That's a really hard sell for some parents, and as you know, probably. These are some of the things that school nurses, that you guys have seen, that you've had to do for some of our patients, and I have to give you guys kudos, because a lot of times you're doing more than what we expect the parents to do, because sometimes there's some parental issues at home that we don't want the parents to be doing these things. So medications, that's something you guys are very familiar with, taking temperatures for fevers and whatnot. We've actually had school nurses that call us and say, you know, this kid showed up with a fever, and we're not surprised because we don't expect that the parents will ever take this kid's temperature just because that's what kind of parent they are, or that's what they're demonstrating themselves to be. We ask some school nurses to take care of a central line because we don't want to put syringes in, or we're worried about sterility at home because we don't think that some families fully understand how important that is. Sometimes we ask family or the school nurses to keep supplies in their offices because we're concerned about drug use in the home. So we've had a lot of this where the school nurse will keep the supplies and the visiting nurse will go to the school's office and do labs, access the Metaport, because we don't want to keep those needles there in the families. Even doing subcutaneous injections, we've had school nurses do that too, because again, we don't want the needles in the household. And then, unbelievably, as you guys know, school nurses are often social workers and just coordinators of how you get a child to their chemotherapy. Or we've had one school nurse who even helped a homeless child find housing for their chemotherapy. So kudos to you guys for kind of stepping up to the plate for all different types of jobs. Now, the school transition can be pretty tough. And you can understand why. So a lot of our chemotherapy regimens during induction involves a lot of steroids because we're trying to get the inflammation down, try to stop the growth, trying to do all these different things. And steroids is a wonder drug. It does a lot of stuff. But steroids can make it difficult for the kids. One, because their appearance changes. They get Cushingoid. And this is very difficult for some kids and some girls. particularly, and boys too, and their mood changes. So we've had kids who are just monsters when they're getting their steroids, and they end up at your school, so in those monster phases. Just so you know, for our leukemia patients, they do, through that three-year time period, they do steroids once a month, a week of steroids at least once a month. So that is once a month, you know, for a whole week, they're showing up to your classes completely crazy. Maybe they haven't slept because their steroids are making them nuts. They can't concentrate. They've got ADHD on top of their steroids. It's a huge headache for everyone. We've actually had some kids who are doing kindergarten enrollment, and the way kindergarten enrollment works is, you know, it's on a certain day. Unfortunately, those kids were on steroids, and they couldn't do the enrollment even though we thought they were ready. So schools have had to, make some exceptions and have those kids come back on a different day. And then there's always the bald change, you know, the hair loss change, which is difficult for families. I think one of the most difficult things for you guys probably is the helicopter parents that refuse to leave your office or leave the parking lot, or just become very demanding. And we've seen a lot of demanding families that will call us and say, the school is not doing this and this for us. I want my kid to have only their own desk that they don't share with anyone else, and they have to be able to eat lunch by themselves with no one else because I don't want any other kid to like spit on their food. And we have these long discussions about, no, they have to be normal. We wouldn't be sending them to school if we thought this was a problem. And there's a lot of splitting of what the parents often say. The parents will try to split the team, split us from you guys. And that's one area that I think we could work a little bit on, and we'll get to that down the road. But just so you know, we do tell families, if they're showing up in your schools, we are telling them that they should be in school. And we are telling them that, you know, they can go to the lunchroom with everybody else. They can participate in gym class like everybody else, although their what activities they may be doing is different. They can do just about everything. There may need to be modifications, but they need to be there. So I just wanted to bring out a couple things here about central lines, because this is something that you'll probably see some of our kids with, either in their arm or in their chest, especially when they're first diagnosed. Just about every kid, when they're first diagnosed, will have some kind of central line that goes in their arm. So this is what we call a PICC line. And it's got, this is an externalized line that we often run in the arm, and the long tube goes to the larger vessels near the heart to give our chemotherapy. A lot of times they'll have this green cap on the end. If that green cap falls off, do not panic. All this green cap is an alcohol swab to try to better protect the line. But a long time ago, like even 3 years ago, we weren't using these green caps. All we were doing is sending our kids with just the end. So it's not a big deal. Don't be worried if you lose the green cap. The one thing that you guys should be aware of, though, is there's this flange, a little spongy thing on the line. You should not see this. If you're seeing this spongy, like a part of the line that's thicker, that line is about to fall out. So you need to call the family and call us right away, because this is the lifeline for this kid about getting chemotherapy, getting drugs, getting blood draws done. So if you see this little spongy thing, this thicker part, call us, because that's something that we would consider somewhat of an emergency. What else is on here? This is another type of central line that's implanted under the skin. This is called a metaport, and you'll see a bump here. The way we access this is a specialized needle, so it's not a straight-on needle, it's a right-angled needle. A lot of our nurses in the community will hold these in their clinic, because that's where the school, the visiting nurse will come and do their labs, just so you know what that looks like. There's this thing called EMLA, which is that numbing cream on the skin. We've had a lot of school nurses that when the kid is about to go to their appointment, the kid swings by the nurse's office, the nurse sticks on the EMLA, they get in the car, and they're on their way. And unbelievably, if that doesn't happen, the parents forget to put it on, and then they're waiting in our office for like an hour for us to do this. So it's very important. We've actually had other school nurses that administer the anti-nausea medications before they leave school so the child could not be throwing up by the time they walk in. There's anticipatory nausea that we know exists, and that helps a lot. Some of the things that you guys should be scared of, and the things that we're scared of when we send a kid to school. So there's this thing called febrile neutropenia. As I said, this is most likely to occur during that first phase of induction therapy. It's also most likely to be deadly in that first phase of induction therapy. So what we consider fever is anything over 100.4. If you can't remember, if we have you know, we actually just tell families, anything that's triple digits that starts with a one, call us, because that's the easier way to remember. You know, the definition of fever is arbitrary. Who picks that number? If you talk to a sickle cell patient, we think of 101. If we talk to the oncology patient, it's 100.4. Just if it starts with a one, just call us, and then we'll walk you through that. You won't know if they're neutropenic at all. So if the patient shows up in your office and they've got a temperature of 100 anything, you have no idea what this number is because you haven't seen their labs. Just call somebody. This is just a graph to talk about, you know, with a febrile neutropenia patient, the average stay is about 10 days. In the adult population, about 13% of them die during that hospitalization, which is a lot. In the pediatric population, we're down to about 4%. We're just, kids are much hardier. There's this other thing called neutropenic enterocolitis. I think this is probably the scariest one, actually, because a fever, you can take a temperature and know. For neutropenic enterocolitis, all they say is they've got a stomach ache. I mean, that's like very hard for a family to know, for a school nurse to know. And there's lots of reasons a kid who's getting chemotherapy could have a stomach ache. They could be constipated. That's the most common cause. Our chemotherapy agents make them constipated, and it gives them stomach upset and nausea and those kinds of things. But this is the one that about 50% of patients who present with neutropenic enterocolitis, even in the pediatric world, are not going to come out of the hospital. So that's the one that scares us the most. This is a question that we get a lot about, fever or viruses in the school. The ones that we actually care most about are things like shingles or chickenpox and Fitz disease, parvovirus. Everything else is kind of like, that's fine. You know, just let us know, they'll be okay. There's nothing we can really do about it. Parents get upset that why are they sending this kid to school with a rash? And what we actually talk to them about is, you know, that kid showed up to school, but they were already infected days before they even showed up to school. So don't blame the school about that. And don't blame the other parent because they didn't know, you know, at this time period. So the only ones you really care about is the shingles or chickenpox and parvovirus. After that, you manage like everybody else does. Homework. This is a difficult subject for families. We do tell them, as I said, the bump on the road, they still have to do their work. That's very important. They still have to participate in sports. We do give our families this thing that talks about what they can actually do given their platelet counts. And this is a resource for you, too. There's actually a website called itpkids.org. It's up here. And on this website, this is actually for patients who have low platelet counts, but there's actually very helpful information about what can your child do at a certain platelet count. And the thing that might be most helpful for you is anyone, doesn't matter if their platelet count is 2,000 or 5,000, can walk during their phys ed program. They could walk around, they could actually even do some of the skills training, so if the child is playing soccer, they can certainly do all that footwork that they've been doing. They might not be able to scrimmage, but there's lots of things that they can do. So we do want those kids to be active. As I said, this talks about if your platelet count is below this, you shouldn't do these things. If your platelet count is between 30 and 50,000, it's usually okay to do X, Y, or Z things. So there are things that ways that we can empower our families and you guys to help keep these kids active. Some other resources, some other interesting things about pediatric patients who have cancer is we actually know that kids with cancer are bullied, or at least the reports of bullying, are 3 times more in kids with cancer than the general population, which is a sad thought. This is a 2013 study. And so we think we're doing a good job educating the rest of the school and the kids. You know, you guys probably do some kind of your classmate has cancer, it's not contagious, those kinds of talks. But this still happens. And I think what is happening is the kid is fine. The bullying is fine for the first 6 months, but kids forget that their classmate is having chemotherapy for 2.5 more years. And we forget to remind the schools that the kid is having chemotherapy for 2.5 more years. And as you all know, anybody with a chronic illness, anybody who's not participating in school as much, or who is perceived as not being able to do all the physical things that another child might do, is at risk for bullying. I think that probably that's one area of improvement is saying, even though the kid's hair is starting to grow back, they're still going to miss school because they're still getting chemotherapy. They still might not be able to do everything else that the next kid is doing, but they might look very normal. And that's when the bullying happens, actually. So we probably need to do a better job about that. So we've talked about transition of school, things to watch out for. We've talked about their expectations to participate in life. We've talked about the disease, the child. I'd like to talk a little bit about the family, just so you know what happens with these families. What people don't realize is how much time families, or what happens to families when they have a child who's been diagnosed with cancer. The amount of care that is provided, it's a full-time job. When your child has cancer, more than 40, you know, there's a third of people spending 40 or more hours taking care of their kid with cancer. This is good at the beginning. If they're continuing to do this, this is bad, actually. So we have all kinds of families that fall into these different ranges. At the beginning, we have plenty of parents who are in this lower end at the scariest time, and we are frustrated. But then we have other families that are well into this range, but then 2 years later, they're still sitting in the school parking lot. So lots of variation. But I think that one thing that everybody can recognize is that it's hard to keep working. So if you're a two-income household that needs to survive, we do know that a lot of parents, one of them needs to stop working to make this work, given how many other kids, how far away they live. We have kids, since we're the only center in this area, we have kids who drive 2.5 hours for their chemotherapy. So that's huge. So it is a job loss in those situations. The other thing that's pretty amazing to me, whenever I look at this, I'm shocked still, is treatment being denied or rescinded by the insurance company. 81.6% of somebody's treatment is being denied. And it's not the entire treatment. It may be I'm not paying for that drug, or that we're not going to pay for, you know, some shot that they need or something. And this happens frequently with some of our more expensive shots. The adults get this medication called Neulasta to help their white cells, stimulate their white cells so they're at less risk for infection. Most insurance companies will not pay for Neulasta. The out-of-pocket cost for Neulasta is about $4,600 for that. So we have to find funds to help them with that, which is absolutely mind-blowing to me, but it does happen. Because of these out-of-pocket costs and the number of things that aren't covered, families are spending a lot of their own income to try to cover these things. We have a good portion spending more than $10,000, but even at these lower ranges, spending, you know, $2,500 to $10,000 for a family whose median income is, let's say, you know, in New Hampshire, median income is like $32,000. That's a third of their income. It's really shocking. So these families are not only stressed with their child's health, but they're stressed about their financial health. So that is what you guys end up having to deal with, all of those stresses showing up at your front door. I'd like to give you some resources that you could use, because I'm not going to be able to be around all the time to have these discussions with you. And what can you use when you get home, and what can you use in your schools that can help you? So there's a wonderful website called curesearch.org. If you look over here, there's an area, if you look on the tabs, there's a school support area. This school support thing has guidance for school personnel, guidance for parents, learning problems during their treatment. Inside, if you press the guidance for school personnel, there are actually movies that you can watch. So this may be something that you want to show in, I don't know, for a faculty meeting, if you're just trying to figure out the transition of your child to school. But some of that, there's a two-part, caring for students after the diagnosis, reintegration into the classroom. There's actually some PowerPoints on there that you guys should feel free to manipulate how you want to use them for however works best for you. There's some ones that talk about managing during school during and after treatment, because even after treatment, there's some issues right off the bat as soon as they stop treatment. There's a special section about adolescents, because they have their own set of problems as it is anyway, and adding cancer to that makes it that much harder. But I would highly recommend that you use this resource and use it for your schools. I think it's very helpful. It's just that you guys don't know about it, probably. I would like to spend the next kind of 10-15 minutes just talking about how can we work better together kind of things. One of the things that I came up with while I was putting this discussion together is that I realized, you know, we give our parents handbooks, we give them pamphlets, we give them lots of printed information, not that they always use them, but we actually, on the day one talk, we give them a big binder notebook, and it comes in different sections. There's a section about clinical trials, there's a section about the diagnosis, there's a section about some integration into school, there's a section about medications, neutropenia, fever, all of those things. So, and every time they get a new chemotherapy medication, we add that to their notebook, and we give them a roadmap so they know they're supposed to come for chemo, or we think they're going to, depending on what their counts are and they're ready, they've recovered from their last one. We can tell them so they can anticipate when their next chemotherapy is. Then I realized when I was doing this, we don't do anything for you guys in terms of this kind of detail. And in some ways, I think that's more important for you to know. Yes, it's important for the families to be able to manage their lives. But in terms of school integration, it's important for you to know, when is this child taking steroids? So you can be prepared for that. When is this child getting a medication that causes constipation? So you know if they're showing up in your office that it could be constipation. When is it that the child is going to miss school probably or be inpatient so you can move kind of the academic schedule around for them? So that's something that I've assigned myself to hopefully put together in the next 6 months to try to help you guys out with that. So when we have a kid, we'll try to send the packet, this is how I envision it, sending you the packet, and then as things come up, we'll probably just fax them to your office to put in that packet. Can you guys think of any other things that you might want to have in that packet? And certainly you don't have to think of them now, but if you do, let me know. Oh, and then I'll put the website, some resources for you guys in that packet. Some things that I would like to talk about, though, kind of more in an open forum, is medical marijuana, because that's become a hot topic with our families today, and truancy and neglect. So let me talk about the truancy and neglect thing first. So as I talked about before, you know, we expect children to go to school, and there's clearly not enough communication, I think mostly probably from our end, because we don't always call the school nurses, which I think is bad on our end, to say this child is ready to go to school. So the parents just show up whenever they feel like bringing their kid in, which is unfortunate. And we also know that we have some families that those kids had problems with school attendance before their cancer diagnosis, and now they have this cancer diagnosis, and that school attendance problem has gotten even bigger. And we've had a few cases recently where there's been discussion, well, should we call DCYF? Who's going to call DCYF? And there's a discussion because you guys don't know, is this kid really too sick to come to school or not? So that's one area that I think we could definitely improve. But let me tell you how I think about the DCYF thing. We will definitely call DCYF if we think that there's a medical neglect issue. And they don't show up to appointments, they're not doing what they want. But we're really, and I'm not sure this is the right answer, so I'd love to hear from you guys about it. We are trying to distance ourselves from calling for educational neglect. And I'm not sure that's right, actually, because we should be thinking about the whole child. And clearly when we put this divide in there, it's not quite right. And I'm not sure it's right because then it causes splitting. It causes splitting where the family is saying, oh, the school things were horrible, you guys, you know, that kind of thing. So I don't know if that's right. But one of the reasons that we try to, if there's this issue about educational neglect, one of the reasons we try to ask that you guys make the referral is because we don't want to create more problems with their medical care. But it is a touchy subject, so I would love to hear what you guys have to say about that and how you think about that.
Well, I think immediately these kids should be put on a 504, and that could be discussed when you talk about reentry to school, that the kids, if they're not already on an IEP, we need to do a 504. And also then, right away, the release of information could be signed right then and there.
Just so you know, that release of information, we actually, when we meet them, we get a series of releases of information. Their school, their pediatrician, and you know other people. So when we meet them, before they've left the hospital, they should have signed a release of information to talk with you guys at the school, just so you know.
And then anything that you talk to them, it could be just mailed to us, because parents often forget to bring things in. And then we don't have the specifics in front of us, mm-hmm. But we could devise pretty flexible, incredible 504 plans if we have the specifics. And, you know, as you can well imagine, in your office, families are only hearing part of it. Mm-hmm. You can't hear the whole thing at that time.
Mm-hmm. So, any other thoughts? Yep.
We actually work really closely with the child life specialist drug department and also the social worker, and invited them to wraparounds. We just kind of tried to envelop the family and just, you know, wanted them to know that we're all working together as a team, and it wasn't us against them. And it just seemed to work much more collaboratively when we did that instead of trying to call. Unfortunately, we did end up having to call DCYM, which they didn't really do anything about because he had cancer. So it's tricky.
It is. It's very tricky.
You just approach it as trying to work collaboratively. It works very well.
Mm-hmm. I have a student that is in high school, and post-radiation, like 10 years ago, is having side effects and is extremely tired. And we sit down in a meeting and we all agree that we're going to cut back her assignments and the expectations. But then to get her to actually go to the classes is very difficult because I can't get any clear guidelines. She has several caregivers, and I've asked them for guidelines, but nobody's kind of driving the ship.
Right. And that's why I think if we could collaborate a little bit better, I agree that we should be sending you guys more information that this patient just got radiation. It's going to be tired, but this is what most of our kids will be able to do afterwards. And clearly, as I was putting this together, I'm glad I got the opportunity to talk about it because I never really thought, I mean, I did my job every day, but thinking about all these gaps in communication, which is where there's huge problems, this was fantastic, for, a good opportunity for me.
I think it's great that you're in communication with the school. I think it's not your job to always know, or it's not always you're not always able to know exactly how many days the child has missed, how many they're tardy. So the communication, being able to talk to the schools, is wonderful, and that's something that a lot of the primary care physicians don't have in place yet.
Mm-hmm.
But that ultimately, if you're communicating with the school, then they can know that the kid should be here, and then they can be the one to report mm-hmm. that the kid's not there mm-hmm. like they should.
Right.
So I mean, I don't think it's necessarily your job, but the communication part is what makes it all. It answers all the questions to know what the right call is.
Right.
I didn't know if you could just talk about some of the family dynamics post diagnosis, because I know, like, for some of my, I'm the sped nurse in my district, and it's very challenging when there's a diagnosis with the IEP, and sometimes the families just fall apart. And what resources you have at Hitchcock that may complement, maybe it's a child life specialist, but I noticed that some of the families I've had walking through cancer or walking through the discovery of an intense diagnosis that means the child is an IEP, and they, it just seems like the body just falls out of the family.
Yeah, we definitely have some families like that. We always have families like that. There is certainly evidence that shows that the kids' transition to school and their success when they go back into school is based on what was that family's functioning even before the diagnosis. And this is no surprise to you. So if they're just skeetering along and then this happens, the bottom does fall out. I've had some schools where we actually send in a letter for the IEP thing. But we don't send that in unless somebody asks. So sometimes we don't know what's going on at school. Again, a communication thing that I think we should be picking up the phone more frequently and saying, hey, this kid is not at school, or something doesn't seem right. Is this right? Does this sound right to you? Because a lot of times we're like, oh, they have cancer, so what, you know, maybe this is right. But I think even when we think things are going okay, they probably are not always. You know, there's things that we are missing, certainly. So, yep.
I know you had said this earlier, but I think if as doctors, if you can, in part of your process, mandate on your own office that you send out things to the school. We don't get that information. And
yeah.
We don't have HIPAA releases. And
right. We should
bug the parent to find out what's going on. And
yeah.
How do you practice?
So one reason why I'm so hopeful this is going to work is we're about to get a new social worker, hopefully, in the next couple of months. So now there's a job for this social worker. We're actually down a social worker. We're down a nurse, a triage nurse in our office. So things are a little bit scattered in our office, too. But I'm hoping that as personnel starts to come back, we'll be able to get these things in place for you.
But even if you can have that part of your discharge.
Yes. You know. That's a good thing to add on. That's a good idea. We do have a discharge thing, like, do they have the meds? Did the teaching happen? Do they have a thermometer at home? But if we could ask, we could add a little box down at the bottom. Has there been adequate school communication? I think that we should add that. That's not on the list currently. That's a good suggestion.
I've noticed that when parents find out their child has a potentially terminal illness or a chronic disease, that they start making excuses immediately for the child as to why they can't get things done. When we as a school believe, well, the child probably actually could be completing this.
Mm-hmm.
So I just had a doctor recently who wrote me a doctor's note for our 504 meeting that said, currently, this child has no medical reason why she can't be completing her homework.
Did I write that?
But once I presented it at the meeting, like, I didn't hear from the parents again. Mm-hmm. The kid was at school, and she was completing her homework. But I think that they actually made their child believe, oh, I can't do this.
Yeah, I think that's definitely true a lot of the time.
Really helpful, that
mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think that if we had something to help us to talk, communicate with the families, to like advocate for that student to be back in school.
Yeah.
But sometimes the parents are like, oh no, he had a fever and he can't come in.
Right.
You know, and we never see the child as a tutor. And once they have a tutor, well, he has a tutor. Why
yeah.
Do they need to come to school?
Yeah, that's a big problem that we face, because we always tell them, yes, the tutors, if they can't go to school, but it's really important for them to go to school. So it sounds like even just at the beginning, if we put to our checklist, is sending a letter for in anticipation of an IEP or 504 to say, yes, their kid's going to miss some days, but we do expect them to be able to do walking in, you know, for their sports activity, to be able to go to classes when and do some amount of homework. That would at least be helpful, I think, it sounds like, for the initial 504 IEP planning.
When your social worker nurse gets back in place, it'd be great to know who the resources for if things get really complicated, how can we liaison? Can the school nurse come to Dartmouth for a meeting if parents agree, or is there somebody that could come to the school for a meeting to kind of really support us in situations that are not going
yeah.
well? Because
and I've actually thought of that, too. I thought it would be, but I think this is a big burden on your time. But certainly, if you guys want to come and see with the family to see just exactly what happens, because every time we do, our patients do come, we do try to have the social worker see them, our child life specialist. So that could be an opportunity to do these kind of activities
for some
and coordinate.
That would be helpful
yeah.
because we're the
right.
medical provider.
Right,
for
right.
Points, you know.
Yeah, you are the medical provider, certainly, for many of our families.
How long is your typical day one conversation?
Our day one, we call it day one, but day one really may be day five, like 5 days of day con. And a lot of it will depend on how much the family wants to know at that time period. We've had some families, it's not that uncommon that we start off that conversation and the mother or father passes out and throws up, and that's the end of day one. It can really drag on for a while, not drag on, but it can take a long process to do that.
So. Following on
that. Oh wait, going back to the day one thing. They will not have gone to school. We will finish that day one conversation before they're back in your school though. So so they won't be
part of the communication with the school. It'd be good to know what the child does know, what the parents are comfortable
That's
with,
a good
where
thought too.
At, because we might know a lot more than they know potentially and we don't wanna share information by accident that they're not
right. Right. So in general, before they go back to school, the children, even the young ones, know that they have something that's wrong with their blood, and we're giving them medicines to make it better. That's the basics. And even the adolescents, they know what the name of their diagnosis is. They know that they're going to lose their hair. We have all the side effect conversations with them. Sometimes the things that we don't tell the adolescents quite yet because they're just overwhelmed with the initial things is we don't talk about next steps sometimes. You know, we talk about chemo today and chemo next week, but we won't talk about like 2 months from now you're going to get radiation, or 3 months from now we're going to talk about amputating this part of the tumor or whatever. So we don't do that right at the beginning. So it is, I think that's a good point to talk about what does this child know so far. Yeah.
Just curious how many parents choose not to tell their children, or is it?
We actually do not allow any family to walk out of the room without having told their kid, because we know 100% of the children will figure it out by themselves in the room. And actually, even on the day one, that the first day they walk into our clinic, we have books that kids have written themselves. You know, like that we have a little, I don't know, it's like a guest book or something that the kids write about their cancer experience in there. And it's in the teen lounge. So the kid hangs out in the teen lounge. We talk to the parents. They're going to pick that up and read it and be like, oh, I must have cancer. You know, so there's no way. And we also talk to families. There are plenty of families. I have to say, I had one Hanover High parent a while ago who wanted me to give the chemotherapy in the general pediatrician's office so they wouldn't have to tell their child that they had cancer. And at the same time, they're telling me that this child's an honor student at Hanover High. And I'm like, are you kidding me? You know, you think your kid's not going to figure it out? And we have this very serious conversation. It's best to use the right words right away. Talk about it being a cancer. Talk about it being a leukemia. Talk about hair loss. All of those things, because they're going to find out from their kids, and you don't want to be a liar in front of your kids, you know? So we do have that conversation.
I just thought of one other, basically cut and dry regarding the truancy issue. Anytime the child has an appointment, you know, the school can receive notification of it. And again, some parents are really
yeah.
good about bringing the papers in, and then we really do know when they've had appointments or when they're.
That is a good thought. That is a good thought, just so you know, right?
Whether they're emailed, not emailed, but whether they're faxed to the school or, you know,
That's a good point, especially for the kids that were concerned about their attendance. Exactly. I did want to say one quick thing about medical marijuana. It's being asked a lot of about a lot of our families will ask for it. We actually tell families that we won't register them because one, they're kids, and two, the reason we don't register them is we have lots of FDA approved marijuana synthetic derivatives that come in a pill, so we know exactly what's in there. So if the child needs it, then we'll certainly give them that. But we don't want them to go trying something if they haven't tried the things we already have for them. So we are pretty staunch about that, which makes a lot of families unhappy. It's funny because they're asking me for it and the room smells like marijuana already. So I'm just like, really? I'm like, I think you're not having any problem finding it. So, one last question.
Do you ever work with Eastern medicine?
We do. We call it complementary medicine, and we are very open to using complementary medicine. And I don't even call it alternative medicine because it's not one or the other. I think that there's definite ways that you can use both together. So, okay. Thanks, everyone.